You're listening to Inside North Central Massachusetts, powered by the North Central Massachusetts Chamber of Commerce.
There he is.
Good morning. Sorry, I was on another chamber meeting.
We double booked you this morning. Well, we're glad that we have you here. And for those who, again, who are joining us, we have Leominster Mayor Dean Mazzarella here for our latest live mayoral chat. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for spending most of your morning with us between this and another call we were just on. We appreciate your time. Now, earlier this week, a unique object ended up in your office. Tell us about what you know about this sword and how this now became your responsibility of mayor. This was all over NBC10. I know that I've seen tons of posts about this online. So how did this sword come into your possession?
I'll show you the sword. Three-dimensional, 3D. Let me show you. It's a pot here. You can see it says U.S. We think it's U.S. Army at the time. So what happened is the we received the box, and inside the box was the sword. And then some limited information, like the sword was taken, either more than likely stolen or unauthorized. And it was, they believe, Fitchburg. It was taken from Fitchburg. And it was more than likely taken between 1976 and 1980. More than likely, it was 1976, 1977, something like that. Anyway, the person who took it passed this on to someone and asked them to see if they could find the rightful owner. That person, the original person that had it, passed away. So before he passed away, I assume it was a he, but he passed it on to somebody. And I guess they felt they'd send it to me and we could find it. So the package actually came from California.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting. So anyway, we're trying to find where it might have come from. We've got a few leads. You know, there are a couple hypotheticals. It could possibly be this. It could possibly be from the Civil War. There were some things I heard stolen from the Fitchburg Historic Society around that time. And then there was another sort of clue about some, maybe another possible stolen piece in Lancaster. So we're just, the media just jumped on this. I guess they found it interesting. But so we're trying to find out. I mean, I think it would be really neat if we could, get this back to where it originally came from. And I think that was, apparently the person that passed away must have had second thoughts about it. And wanted to make sure that it got back, and whether he knew where he took it from, or maybe because of his illness, he didn't. I don't remember the particulars, but I don't know the particulars, I should say. I'm just sharing with you what they gave me. And so some of my comments might be hypothetical.
And again, for those who are joining us, just a reminder, if you do want to submit your questions for the mayor, you can do so right in the chat box. We're happy to take those throughout this broadcast. Now, yesterday also saw another round of vaccines being given out at that last mile vaccination clinic at the mall at Whitney Field. How was the turnout, and how was this impacted now by the announcement of the temporary pause on Johnson & Johnson vaccines?
So originally, we remember, the last mile is very labor intensive. We're reaching out to those that have the most difficult time, whether it's a language barrier or some sort of a special need, age, or just having a difficult time navigating, connecting to getting a shot. But this morning, a lady had relative had called us and said, my aunt has dementia and she's really had a hard time. Other people have tried, can't seem to get her an appointment. And so we reserved a spot for her. But so it's labor intensive because we call everybody and then we gather some information and then we call to remind them. And then when we got the news about the J&J, we had to call and tell them, that it's on hold. But then yesterday we were able to get backup supply and enough to be able to run the clinic. We ran the clinic yesterday. We'll run it. We're running another one today. And that's mostly factory workers and production. And then we have another one tomorrow. So we're pretty much caught up. Only we're replacing it with other vaccines.
And one of the other things we saw too was a home vaccination program. Is that going to be continuing with these other brand of vaccines?
Well, what's helpful with the Johnson & Johnson is it didn't need to be refrigerated. It was one shot. It was really a great tool for anybody that was homebound. And unfortunately, that is not the case anymore. That's on hold. We don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. So it just might have to be that, you know, we move forward with without the Johnson & Johnson. So those are the things that were, you know, but we still want to continue on putting our list together. So if anyone knows anyone, you know, that can help us to find those, the hardest to find, or those that are homebound, just give us a call at 978-534-7500, extension 0.
I think that's one of the other questions that a lot of people have is, you know, keep hearing about this clinic at the mall and folks are wondering, you know, is it open to the public? How do you get on that list to get a phone call for one of those coveted spots to get one here at the mall and to not have to drive to Gillette or to another community?
Well, it is the last mile. So the reason we're getting these shots is to reach out to those that have the most difficult time. And as I just explained, so it's not open to just anyone. There are many sites and vaccination sites across the state, even here, some in Leominster, you know, CVS's and Walgreens and Hannaford's and Health Alliance. There are a number of places already doing. Our job is to get to those that are hardest to reach. And that's specifically why we're getting those shots. So that's why I say, if anybody knows anyone, please send them our way, or you can send an email to vaccine@leominster-ma.gov.
Now, the city recently signed a contract for just over $150,000 with the Department of Public Health. How are those funds going to be helping COVID-19 vaccinations and preventions in the city?
So we've been doing that outreach with, let me just shut this off. We've been doing the outreach with our staff. And so we're trying to get all of our work done, plus this outreach, which, as I said, is very labor intensive. It's a phone call, and many times it's not easy sort of communicating, either a language barrier, or somebody might have a, you know, hearing problem, or, you know, dementia, and so very labor intensive. But everyone's done just a fabulous job with the most amount of patients, and they're happy to do it. So these funds will be for us to be able to hire an outreach worker to be able to help coordinate all of this. So we'll still continue to help out. We'll still work. We'll still be, you know, the backbone of the system here. But it's going to allow us some more, you know, some more staff to help us to really get out and do the outreach. Because we're going to continue to get these vaccines for this specific reason.
And you mentioned that you're teaming up with some manufacturers even to do that. Are you anticipating down the road you'll be able to keep doing some of those workplace vaccinations to help out with different industries in the city?
Absolutely. We're reaching out to all manufacturers in the community, and even in temporary employment agencies, churches, whoever is out there.
Now that spring is here, despite what we're seeing in the weather forecast with snow spring here, and there's been a lot of talk about outdoor dining. Can you tell us about the outdoor gas heaters that the city now has for restaurants?
We still have some here, but we are loaning these outdoor gas heaters to restaurants who are doing outdoor dining. Last year we approved outdoor dining. We're very flexible with it. Some, you know, most participate, some don't. And so we have these heaters and we're lending them out. And, you know, when they're done with them, they can return them. And, you know, reasonable amount of wear and tear. We don't supply the gas. They are responsible for the gas. So this will give them an early start, because you might get those, you know, this is a lot like September, October. You get those warm days, but the nights cool off. Most people are going to go out to eat, you know, after 5, 6 o'clock. So it's just another tool that they can use, you know, help bring business in. So it's we've got a few left, not many, but a handful. So they went quick.
And how did the city obtain those? Did the city go out and buy those? Was it done through a grant? How did you end up with that supply?
We applied for a grant to help our businesses. And so we've actually purchased a number of those A-frame sandwich boards that businesses can put out in front of their businesses. You know, they're anywhere from $100 to $150. We'll be able to give those to businesses. Our first order, they came in one color, they're wrong color. We sent them back. They sent the right color. We'll be able to distribute those. They'll all be consistent. They'll all be the same color. And yes, so what, you know, so the heaters, that was all from a grant to help, you know, with our businesses. Other towns and cities chose to use them in a different, to use those funds in a different area. We felt this is, these were things that really could help those businesses. They're a short supply as well, too. I don't know if anybody tried to find one. I guess recently they've been more plentiful, but we were happy to get the amount that we got and get them so soon so we could distribute it.
And you mentioned you have a few left. How many have been given out so far, approximately?
I would say about 36 have been given out. We probably have just under a dozen left. Yeah.
So if businesses are interested in those, do they call your office? What's the call process?
Our office. Well, you can call Melissa if you'd like. You can start here with 534-7500 extension 0, and then we'll transfer you out to make sure you get one.
Now, if you keep seeing a demand for more after that dozen's gone, do you anticipate trying to obtain more that you can loan out to restaurants?
Sure. If that's the call, I mean, we stay in touch with the businesses. We'll be coming out with a brochure listing all the different restaurants in town, the different small businesses in town. You can't just, anybody knows from having a business, you can't just use one media or one platform to get your message out. It really has to be everywhere. And so we do some print, we do some, multimedia campaigns. And that's our efforts now, is to really, we've got new restaurants and endeavors opening and new businesses. And so we want to, constantly, it's like, you go to buy a car, you buy furniture. They have to advertise everywhere, because you might ignore all those ads, but the very moment that you're looking for a car, you decide you're going to buy a piece of furniture, all of a sudden you're paying attention to those ads. So, and they can't just advertise in one place. And so you really have to be everywhere, and you have to keep, pushing that message out. But that's pretty much our local small business campaign this year, is to start with the publicity part of it all, and back it up with these heaters and message boards and print advertisement and whatever else it takes, social media, et cetera.
Now, you mentioned that last year the permitting became very flexible for those that want to do outdoor dining. If people did outdoor dining and they plan on doing it again this year, do they have to reapply for the outdoor permit, or are they just kind of grandfathered? How does that work?
The only thing is, the license commission held that establishments would close at 11 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And the state rule is they've relaxed a lot of the regulations, but what is still required is that the tables be 6 feet apart, that you'd spend no more than 90 minutes at a table, that there'd be food on the table, and that in Leominster, we've kept you've got to close at 11 o'clock at night. And the reason really is that the restaurants, you want the food part, and not for it to turn into a social gathering where, those are the spreaders, right? We've had some sporting events across the state, and those are the spreaders. That's where they spread. And when people have gatherings inside their house and the windows aren't open and it's cold and it's the holiday season, that's where we saw the spreaders. So trying to eliminate that. But other than that, we're as flexible as can be. If they want to take over half the sidewalk and build a little platform so people can walk around, a temporary situation, whatever it takes to accommodate them.
And now we're seeing some new businesses that have come online. I know there's a few more. When I drove downtown yesterday, I saw the former Auntie Ellen's. The windows were down, and there was actually construction workers kind of on ladders on both sides in and out of the establishment. So we're going to see more businesses opening up. I know there's more planned restaurants. For those newer restaurants, are they going to have an easy time getting that outdoor permitting as well?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's not going to be an issue. It's just more of a logistics and how do you do it. So, mm-hmm. If you take the sidewalk and have people out into the sidewalk, then you just build a small sort of a deck out so that people can walk across town and then get back, kind of a bypass to the sidewalk. So we're encouraging that. We always have. I mean, several years ago, we started a Dining Under the Stars, and it was down towards that Mezcal area. And there were 4 to 6 different restaurants that were there. A couple of food trucks came in. And it was on a Wednesday night, when it's typically slow for businesses in the summer. And I think we put out 400 seats. They were filled at 4 o'clock when we opened. And then we had another 400 people that, were standing, or, people had left and other people had come in. So we had close to 1,000 people that night each time we did it. So that was sort of our experiment to outdoor dining and how it would work. And so we encouraged, music and entertainment. But by 11 o'clock, we're to that sort of silent mode where we don't want restaurants to turn into a tavern setting. We want them to be there and eating food and having beverages, but with a combination of the two. And we found that to be most successful.
Now, obviously, we're still dealing with the pandemic, and that's kind of why we're seeing the big push for outdoor dining. But if you look, you know, down the road, once we are out of this mess, once things return to either normal or what they call the new normal, do you see outdoor dining becoming more of a fixture in Leominster, like we see in some of the big cities in other parts of the country?
I sure hope so. I think, you know, that's why we did Dining Under the Stars. We're really trying to encourage restaurants to go that avenue. Now, there's some expense and some inconvenience to it, and, you know, it is. But we think, as judging from the old, you know, Ryan Time, the old Monument Grill, and now The Fix, you know, they've always been the first nice day of the year. There are more people on the outside eating than there are on the inside. And so we've been trying to encourage that for years. You know, Tara and I prefer to eat outside when the weather's good, because the rest of the year you're inside. So if we can eat outside, we're very happy to be able to do that. And I think a lot of people are, and I think more people are now, you know, looking for that option of having the outdoor seating. And obviously in a day when maybe it's raining or snowing or it's cold or whatever. But I think even when it cools off a little in the fall or early late spring, people will still want to sit outside. And that's why we went with the heaters. Now, I know some of the businesses bringing back tents, you know, and that's fine. And but yeah, especially downtown where we've got three or four new restaurants opening, we really want to push that. It creates a whole kind of European feel for our downtown. It brings people in, brings them back. You know, many people come and visit from out of town. And when they visit those restaurants, they might come back to the other restaurant that was just down the street that they never knew about, but they came for this one particular one, or maybe that restaurant's full. So they decide to, you know, do a little Yelp surfing and find out there's another restaurant down the street, and they have, you know, they have a reservation that's open. And so, you know, the more we kind of took a little bit of criticism before for trying to encourage restaurants to come to town, but it really does work, where the more restaurants bring the more people, and more people, you know, visit those restaurants. And there are some people that have their favorite absolute restaurant, and that's the one they go to every single time, El Camino. And then there are people that will go to El Camino once or twice, and they'll go visit other restaurants. And so it really does work at the end, even though there's skepticism. At the end of the day, we bring a lot of people into the city. And there are a number of times I've gone out, different times of the year, different seasons, different times of the day. And it literally counted how many cars there are in the parking lot of our restaurants. And you can walk to a restaurant and find half of the people aren't even from Leominster. They're from, you can zip, you know, you can do the whole credit card sort of heat map and tell where people come from. So, yeah, we encourage all of that, and whatever it takes, and as creative as we can get.
And we do have a question coming in from a viewer. And again, if you're just joining us and you would like to submit a question, just use the question box. That's up with the GoToWebinar menu, and you'll be able to ask a question. Question is, what is the, like, you know, what is, in a little bit of detail, what is the process to actually get outdoor seating for a restaurant? So if a restaurant hasn't been doing it and they come to City Hall and they want to do outdoor dining, what's the process for them that they have to go through?
Well, we just want to make sure they have a safe and secure area. If there's going to be alcohol served, we want to make sure that if people are trying to use the sidewalk, that they have an alternative, you know, that we have to be able to get a wheelchair or someone off. And that's why I said we do a little bit of a bypass. So you just come in with a sketch. You don't have to hire an engineer. You come in with a sketch and a plan. And if we have to tweak it, we'll tweak it. If we can help you with it, we can help you with it. But we haven't run into any problems anywhere. I mean, anybody that's wanted to do it has come in. But we just need to know that there's an area sort of not fenced off, but positioned separately, you know, if they're going to be alcohol being served, that's state law. Other than that, it's pretty flexible, and we can usually give somebody, if they come in with a sketch, we can usually turn that down pretty quickly, turn that around pretty quickly.
Now, yesterday, Leominster did see a visit from the Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, Mike Keneally, Undersecretary of Community Development, Ashley Stolba, and the President and CEO of Mass Development, Dan Rivera. They all came out to talk about the joint effort with the city, the NCMDC, New View Communities, and Spanish American Center on the Urban Agenda Grant, but they also talked about the Big Mass Works Grant project. Can you tell us about the significance of visits like these when you have these folks from Beacon Hill and from Boston come out to Leominster?
You know, long ago, I was going to open a laundromat. It was years ago on French Hill. There was just a small laundromat there. There was a big demand for it. And So bought the property, started pulling, you know, my permits and come up with a, you know, build. It was a new building. And just as I got to the end of the project, the gas company notified me when you have to put in for a clearance. They notified me they didn't have enough gas, not enough pressure to push gas into the area. So there goes that. I mean, that delayed that. And then as soon as I got through that, it was like a year or two. And then I got the plans going again and went down and didn't have the water capacity to provide. City didn't have to provide. Now that's 40 something years ago. They didn't have the capacity to be able to do that. So all those delays got me moving in another direction. So infrastructure is critical. And, you know, at one time, you know, when people didn't conserve or recycle their water, many manufacturers were here and didn't recycle their water. Water is very cheap, so they just used it. We would put out 12, 14 million gallons of water a day. And now we're down to 3 million gallons a day. And it's not that much. We have extra capacity in case there's a business that needs to come into town that uses water. We'll have that capacity to be able to grow. And infrastructure is extremely important. So all that area down, as you get down to where Chipotle is and McDonald's in that area, the infrastructure is extremely old down there. And we'll have the capacity to fix that all and replace all of that infrastructure. And then do the sidewalks over and some road improvements and all of that, and really clean up that area down there. But it's extremely important because as the mall begins to develop and redevelop itself, we need to be able to allow them to tie into the infrastructure. And that's critical. We went through a period of time in the city where, you know, there was major problems with the infrastructure. And those have been taken care of now. And so we can allow, but this is the last piece of that. And it's a $2.4 million grant. It's huge when you're putting in for a MaxWorks grant, which is for infrastructure. So very, very critical. But it's going to help in terms of business expansion in that area. And so, you know, the mall, people are like, yeah, the mall died. And, you know, it's like just roll it all up and just tuck it away and put something down it. That's not the case at all. I mean, the mall and retail is changing. It's going to change and it's going to look different than it does now. But these are mall developers that own it. They were in Reading, Pennsylvania. They tore down 800,000 square feet of their mall development so that they could build new buildings. And the efforts now, I mean, remember, we went from downtown to everyone needed to be downtown to in the 60s and 70s, everybody needed to go to the mall. That was sort of the thing. And now we're getting away from that, and it's back to freestanding buildings and back to downtown. Only we've added in things like, you know, like online ordering and free shipping, and all of that is changed everything. But it isn't going to change, you know, the ability or the willingness or just a natural physical need to get out and shop sometimes. And so they are they're 100% liquid. They have no debt. They have malls all over the country, and they're planning to, you know, they have plans to sort of shrink the mall a little bit to carpet it. They've taken all the kiosks out because they feel that the shopper wants to be able to see from end to end. They don't like all that obstruction in the middle. They can't see the store down, you know, 50 feet away or 100 feet away. You know, it takes away. They went to that store. They look down. They can't really see what's down there. Maybe they turn around and leave. So. They'll invest there. They may do some demolition in the end. And but the big push right now is for more stores that would be located outside of the mall or have a combination entrance, like, say, I guess, like Old Navy has an ability to connect to the mall, but they also have an outside entrance. So it's still the most valuable piece of property in the, you know, in the area. It's one of the few malls in the Northeast that actually has neighborhoods around it. That people walk to it. So one thing, all the mall people that were built, all the people bidding on the property when it was for sale said was, it's the only mall we've ever seen people like walking from every direction or driving in every direction that live within a mile of the mall. If you go to Salmon Pond Mall, there are very few people that live near there. If you go to the Nashua Mall, Pheasant Lane, very few people. The Burlington Mall, there are very few people that actually live near there. There's a high concentration, which makes it unique. So the mall is, they're not going to roll it up or tear the whole thing down. They're going to revamp it, you know, to meet. And the other thing that's interesting is that they want to do a marketplace And so if someone had a great business plan, but they didn't have the, you know, the funds to be able to, you know, fund that idea, but it's a really good idea, they would help actually finance that idea and use some of the, and fill up some of the mall space. So the mall, I mean, you know, people pay big money right now to be outside the mall, and obviously they don't pay as much to be inside. But this is really going to be good for local businesses and startups, because they'll actually have a place to get going. So it'll be a little bit of a different change on how some parts of the mall work. But at the end of the day, you know, they're in it. They're not panicking. They understand the business. They've been in it for a long time.
I want to talk a little bit more about the MassWorks Grant Keneally's visit in a second, but just to follow up, when you talk about the mall's footprint may change, and I know you mentioned the kiosk disappearing inside, but in terms of making the mall smaller, would that include, you know, are we going to see maybe the demolition on the some of those anchor stores that have gone, like the Sears portion or the Macy's portion, and kind of reduce that?
I would say that probably would be the case, that you'll see some demolition on those sides over there. It's hard to repurpose those, because anybody that comes in is going to want to, more than likely, I mean, it may happen, but I mean, more than likely, anybody that comes in has a footprint or, has a specific plan for how they want their, you know, buildings to be built. And many times their layout is the same here as it is in North Carolina or California. It's the same amount of square feet. The bathrooms are in the same spot. You go to pick up whatever that, you know, it is that they sell, it's in the same spot. So unlikely, if not all of that extra space over there would come down, but some of it. And the other thing is, they're in the floodplain, so they have to compensate. Mm-hmm. So when you build in the floodplain, there is extra capacity down there to build in the floodplain, but to that extent, they need to, you know, they can't build new buildings without compensating for the floodplain down there. So that would probably require some demolition. But you know, if you get down there, that whole right hand side of the mall, if you get to Panera and places like the Burlington and some of the shoe store that's inside, and JCPenney, and some of those are still doing well. I mean, it's keeping them all alive at this particular point.
Now, in other parts of the country, we've seen, you know, these developments where we might see retail components on the bottom levels and then see some housing up above. Is that something that's been discussed? And could that area even be used in that regard, or would that require big zoning changes?
I don't think it's a big deal to change it, you know, the zoning. And I don't want to speak for them, but they're not residential housing developers. They're mall retail developers. That's what they know. It's what they do. I would say that would probably come secondary, because their first focus is on building outdoor, you know, freestanding buildings. Mm-hmm. So in retail and restaurants. So, you know, there's a Dairy Queen going down there. That's not on their property, but there's a Dairy Queen going down on there. So more buildings like that on smaller footprints, but also they have room for bigger footprints. So if it was like a Hobby Lobby or somebody that's got, you know, 50,000 square feet or 60, they could easily build those buildings. Mm-hmm. The old Sears building, that might be a situation where maybe they can use it, but maybe they can't. And it's a cost analysis business, right? It's looking at what is the cost to renovate something versus tearing it down and starting new. So I think I have a whole lot of options. They're certainly, you know, the retail world and the capacity of leasing. I've been to a lot of these retail shows across the country. It's a small world. They all know each other. Every player knows the players. And so they know exactly what they're doing, and they know exactly who the players are that aren't here, that should be here, and which ones will, bear the market. And so they were just here not long ago. They'll be back. And so I didn't hear any pessimism from them at all. So that's it. That's good news.
And so you're talking about the MassWorks grant as well, in terms of the increasing that capacity, updating that infrastructure along the state police barracks. It's going to come down as you make your way to the mall. Is that going to tie in to all that work that the state's doing along Route 13? And then my other question is, looking at that MassWorks grant, is that paying for the entire MassWorks portion, or does the city have to kick in for some of that work as well?
No, that's a right grant to pay for all of that. In the end, it's all going to tie into each other. I mean, they're all connected either directly or indirectly. But and so that Route 13 project is really meant to move people through. And, you know, we've spent so much time looking to see if we could build an alternative route into Fitchburg. And then it's become so expensive that administrations have said, let's get all of our roads to move as efficiently as we possibly can, using all the state-of-the-art traffic signals, widening of roads. Why build another road? Let's get our roads to be, it's not cheap to build roads anymore. In fact, there hasn't been a new road built in years in this state. We're fortunate to have one, Interstate 190. It was the last interstate road that was built, that was built in New England. There have been no other interstate roads built. Interstate 190 went from 290 to Route 2 and 13. And so that was huge. But that money isn't coming this way. If things might change with the transportation bill being proposed by the federal government and the president. But in the meantime, it's getting our roads to move as efficiently as we could. If you remember back on 12, there would be backups into Fitchburg, both to and from, every day of the week. And we went into the state and we said, hey, listen, Route 12 and 2 interchange. Every day, it's just a disaster down there. There was accidents, and it's not good for economic development down there. So we proposed to the state to do a massive reconstruction of that area. Fitchburg ended up piggybacking on it, which brought us into the center of Fitchburg. But the real sort of clogging was happening at Route 2 and 12, and so that was fixed. But remember those days when traffic was backed up into Fitchburg, and then off of the highway coming back at the end of the day. So these are important. So Route 13 will help move traffic more safely through that area, move more traffic through the area, and again, at the end of the day, the finished product, if you were looking from a drone, would be a finished product between the MassWorks grant and Route 13 and the interchange, which so badly we need a light at that, where the armory is and where the Sunoco station was, and that's where they're working right now. But that's a big project, but they're not going to pay for new roads at this particular juncture.
And so you're able to talk to Secretary Keneally, Undersecretary Stolba, and Dan Rivera, President of Mass Development, yesterday about the MassWorks grant, about the Urban Agenda grant that you're working with the Chamber on. When you get to talk to these Boston officials about that, how important is that for advocacy for grants and for future opportunities in Leominster?
Extremely. And, it's building those relationships that really help. And the governor had asked me to, and the lieutenant governor asked me to join the board for the Mass, for MassDOT. And one of the reasons was that I was always sort of the advocate for, here we are and, the other side of Massachusetts here, and we don't really have any representation. Everybody's from the East. And we really could use some representation out here. And well, I didn't know they were going to. I wasn't advocating for myself. I wasn't saying, hey, can you put me on the board? But I did get the call from the governor, lieutenant governor, and asked me if I'd like to serve. Former DPW director in Worcester is also on it. So it does bring, believe me, it does bring, building those relationships and being able to advocate not only for Leominster, but, I've been called on to advocate for a whole lot of other projects in the area, and it's helpful. And so Dan Rivera was the former mayor of Lawrence, and many of the people that are in the administration are former either mayors or people that I've worked with in other capacities, and it does help. They know we're here, they know about us, they know what our issues are, and so I think we do pretty well out here with MassDOT, MassWorks. All those things were helpful to be able to advocate for.
One of the other things that's happening downtown is a lot of construction over near the Fix. Can you tell us more about the park grant in front of Monument Square in that area and what that's going to allow you guys to do with the city?
We had this long-standing debate internally here about the common. And there was, and it was very monumental, Monument Square, and there were shrubs, sort of raised yews, maybe 4 or so feet tall, all around the square, which made it very built all around the monuments. So the thought was sort of the balance. We don't want to lose the integrity of having those historic monuments here, which represent various wars and conflicts. And the statue part of it all, we didn't want to lose that. We want to encourage people to come and visit and see the history of our city what people were thinking, you know, back just after World War One, World War Two, Revolutionary War, et cetera. We don't lose that, but commons at first were meant to where people could gather. So how do we balance the two? So the debate was always, how do we do that? And there was a, let's get rid of the shrubs, and oh no, we can't get rid of the shrubs, that'd be worse. And then we finally made a decision, we're gonna take the shrubs out. And it was very scary, but as we were taking them down, the feedback was very good that people wanted that and thought it looked better. And it was more encouraging for somebody to come and throw a blanket down, and we put tables in the middle of it all, little chess tables. And with actually people, I heard people say, nobody's coming downtown to play checkers or chess. Oh, really? Oh, really? We have competitions down here. There's people are sitting outside eating all the time. We haven't had any problems down there. We have walking beats now. But we took a risk, and it ended up in our favor. People thought that was a great thing to do. It looked better. Now we moved across the street. It worked so well, we moved across the street. That whole area from Mechanic Street over to past where Rollstone Bank is. That will be a brand new park, and we'll have lots of landscaping, some seating areas, lots of lighting, outdoors dining for, you know, the fix, and maybe some other vendors. And you can do art venues out there. We've left room for that. But we also put a little water amenity for kids where if they kind of walk over it, you know, the water spurts up to them. And so we're really trying to build a downtown that, that attracts families and people, and that lots of people live around here. And we think it all just comes together. And so that was a grant, and then some of it was funded by the city. But they are moving along. We should be done by the end of May. And they're just moving right along over there. It's going to really, you know, we have a master plan, but it can't all be done in one, you know, one day, one year, one season. And so it's really meant to be a walkable community. And the other thing we're trying to do is, you know, you go to other downtowns and they're smaller, and Fitchburg and Leominster are bigger downtowns. You know, Clinton has a couple of breaks, but as soon as you run a main street between the two, or it ends up being too long, becomes a challenge. And you get smaller downtowns and it's all in one spot. But here we have like a Mechanic Street that breaks it, and then Merriam Ave that breaks it. And so you've got to get shoppers and people that are down here. So, you know, similar to the mall, right? How do you get somebody to look further down the mall and say, oh yeah, there's a shoe store down there, let's take a walk down there. And that's what we're trying to create. Can't all be done overnight, but you know, we have, that I know of, maybe one spot left on the retail end of downtown. And other than that, everything is either spoken for or is already, you know, is already open. There are very few vacancies. Most of the office space, and I say most, is filled as well. So it allows us now to work on things like, you know, how to improve it, how to bring more people downtown, how to connect somebody that went to the fix to the other side of the downtown, which, you know, they might not know was over there. So little storyboards or message boards, you know, just using QR codes or whatever it might be. All of those things are tools in our chest that we'll use to bring more people down and get more people for that shopping experience.
And as people drive through downtown, one of the other things they're going to notice is demolition is largely done, and the site is now being prepped for the police station. This is something that's been in the works for over two decades. Where does the project now stand?
There was a central register public notice that we have to publish prior to going out to bid. That was in the Sentinel Enterprise yesterday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And preparing the final documents to go out the bid. We're actually working on interior selections on colors and rug colors and wall paintings and all that. So we're gonna be going out the bid very shortly, and hopefully award the bid and get the site work going.
And once it does go out to bid, do we have a timeline of when you'd like to see this completed?
It would be next year. And a lot of it will be depending on how much they can get done before winter kicks in. If they can get the frame up and tent it and put heat inside, they can work all winter. If they choose not to and they can't, you know, the timing isn't right, then they'll do similar to what they did on 13. They worked all the way up to January. Once hardcore winter kicked in, they shut it down, but then they opened back up at the 1st of March. So I would suspect it'd be something like that, but I would say, you know, next year in 2022, project will wrap up and the police department will move in.
Now, what is the plan for the existing station and also the former Plastics Museum? I know that was the site you had detectives over there for the past several years. What's going to happen to those two businesses or those two buildings once operations moved to the new station?
So we looked around and we actually bought the building at 210 Lancaster Street for the police station. We moved the detectives in, we had our evidence brought in, and there was a change of minds that maybe we ought to just build a brand new building. At the time, it seemed like the right choice. It wasn't that much more money to build a new building than it was to renovate. That might have changed now with cost of supplies and materials, but even so, I think it's a much better idea to build new. But what we decided to do when we looked at possibly selling it, and we kicked a bunch of options around, and what we decided to do is the building really lent itself to a smaller venue, smaller than say the police station. So we did some training in the building for the fire department, and we've had a number of training events there. It's three, four stories, and it worked out well. And so we met with the fire department and a team of firefighters representing firefighters and deputies and lieutenants and the chief, and said, this building really works for us. And we hadn't thought much about it. We were thinking about bringing all the inspection, all the different inspection departments to one building. And we thought of that. And then, but it really, as we got closer and closer, we realized that building really did lend itself for three purposes. One is there'll be room for community use if people want to use it. If the Boys and Girls Club is running a program, or the YMCA or the Spanish American Center, anybody, the Haitian American, anybody that wanted to use the space could use it. Recreation department, school department, it's in a perfect spot. But it also lends itself to offices for the fire department. There is no handicap access to the second floor of the fire department. So anybody that's working in the offices there must use the stairs. So we're going to move our offices. And then the third component is training. The building is perfect for inside and outside training. So they are in there working. They've done an amazing job. I mean, it's incredible what they've done in a short amount of time. So that's the long term for that. And the old police station, I'm not sure. Before I was looking at trying to save it. Gallagher, the building is pretty filled right now. That building went from being, one third full to the building is at max right now. And so if the fire department doesn't need it, it doesn't look like they will, we may just look towards demolishing it. It's starting to look like downtown with all the new businesses coming in and the office space filling up, it looks like we're going to need more parking. So what we may do, and we're certainly taking a look at it, is maybe just demolishing the building. We don't really have a use for it at this particular point.
Now, Leominster students recently saw a return to the classroom. How has that been so far?
Good. Actually done well. I think most teachers who wanted to get vaccinated could. Next week starts the 16 plus on the 19th to get vaccinated. I assume that'll be that'll probably shut the systems down from so many people trying to get logged in. But it's gone well. It's taken some patience. There were students and parents who, just decided they're going to ride this out and finish off the year doing remote learning, and they're doing fine with that. That's fine. Some kids are really doing very well at remote learning. And, there's an influx. There's $25 million worth of new money going to the school department from last year to the end of this year. And then some of it can be carried forward. But that's a lot of money that we can use towards both, the hybrid system, full-time learning. At the end of this month, all students will return full-time. But it takes everyone working together. It takes parents and bus drivers and everyone directly or indirectly involved. This is all a big change, but it's gone relatively smooth. I haven't seen any bumps in the road at all. It's especially where student or parents who didn't want their students to return and wanted to continue on with remote, they could.
Now, will we see any sort of in-person graduation ceremony at the end of the year over at Doyle Field?
We had one last year, albeit later. I'm not sure they had put out some directive about proms and all that. But it looks like, if we don't do it on, the first Saturday of the month of June, which is customary, then at some point there'll be a graduation like we did last year.
And one of the other big pieces of news, we've been hearing from Leominster is Tony Hawk. I mean, when you think of skateboarding, Tony Hawk comes to mind right away. And now he's
He is one of mine.
He was one of mine, still is. So tell us about Tony Hawk's connection to Leominster now.
So we're building a new skate park. We had a skate park we put in 26 years ago. And at the time, it was like the most modern one because it wasn't made out of wood, and it was, you know, these metal, big steel things, so that, you know, you could do anything you wanted to these things, and they could be painted over. But, you know, we were reaching that point. And as you remember, a good deal of people thought that was just a trend. Skateboarding would come and go, but people that were skating down there at 14 and 15 now have kids that are in their teens who are now skateboarding down there. So the fad never went away. So when unfortunately a young adult here in Leominster who was a big, was into the sport in a big way, and his friends, Frankie Fortuna, he passed away. He was hit by an automobile, passed away from his injuries. And his family and friends really wanted to do something positive. They wanted to take, and that's pretty much what Frankie was all about. They wanted to turn it into something positive. And so they met with actually our grant writer, Wendy Weeks, and it was just so happened to be a grant coming available. Said, this seems like the perfect opportunity. You know, we have these public hearings all the time where, you know, you're doing a project and you have to, part of the process to get the grant is to have a public hearing. And you might get a few people that show up to these public hearings that, you know, we really do advertise them and we want people to weigh in on. But generally, we don't get a huge audience. We'll get some emails, sounds good, blah, blah, blah. There were 100 people at this public hearing at the skate park. So putting, you know, our resources together, their family and friends together, they're doing some fundraising. You know, we're able to pull this off, but they actually said, you know, we're not going to just leave it to the city to build. We felt an obligation. We should be raising money. So they wrote to Tony Hawk and lo and behold, they send in a check for $10,000. So that's a big win for the skate park and for Frankie and for everybody involved. That was like a big, just having Tony acknowledge the fact that we're here was a big deal.
And I've seen some of the preliminary, drawings of what it may look like and different things that have been posted online when they've been soliciting for feedback. And I'll tell you, it's amazing to see how it's going to transform when you drive by and see the one there now, and then you see what it's going to look like. It really is amazing.
Yeah, every time I talked about, you know, modernize it, it was, it's just a fad. And then kids started using it for bikes, which they'll be allowed to do. And I just kept getting it's kind of, you know, seen its time. And I'm like, no, it hasn't. It's just that the people that were skateboarding then are now either skateboarding with their kids or they bring their kids there. So anytime you went by, I don't care what time of day it was, there was always somebody there. Now, it might have been 100 people, but there were always people using it. So it's exciting that we're going to have this beautiful park down there and centrally located to the city where anybody can access it.
Now, for those who are watching right now, if they want to make a contribution to the skate park or if they're looking for help with vaccines, if they're looking to obtain an outdoor heater for their restaurant, like we were mentioning earlier, where can they go to get all this information?
The single point of entry is our office, which is 978-534-7500, extension 0. And then indirectly or directly, we're going to get you the help. But it's really the central kind of clearinghouse and the single point of entry that makes it easy because we know exactly where to send you so that you're not, you know, getting passed around City Hall. You have to come to a number, you know, some offices aren't in this particular building, and we don't want people having to chase everything down. We can make it real easy for you, and that's why we're here.
And for those who are joining us, we've been chatting with Leominster Mayor Dean Mazzarella on our live mayoral chat here at the Chamber of Commerce. And I do want to thank you for your time. We appreciate you joining us every month. And this will be available online on our website at northcentralmass.com. It's also going to be in podcast form. So if you don't have the time to sit here and watch us, but you'd like to take us with you in your car or while you're cooking or doing anything else, you can also listen to us in podcast form on the North Central.
You can't sleep.
Yeah. You can listen to us as you fall asleep. It could be the soundtrack to your dreams. That's the new Inside North Central Massachusetts podcast. Lemon Stewart and Dean Mazzarella, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Enjoy the day.
You've been listening to Inside North Central Massachusetts. This podcast is produced by the North Central Massachusetts Chamber of Commerce. For more information on this episode, links to other episodes on Podbean, or if you have any questions, please visit northcentralmass.com.